Ganley. This is NHPR News at 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. The United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change released more dire predictions recently. Scenarios of melting polar ice caps, acidic dying oceans, heat waves, heavy floods, and other mega weather disasters. And the panel said everyone on the planet will be affected. Chris Field is co-chair of the IPCC report.
We're seeing lots and lots of indications of changes in species locations or in fisheries operations or in agriculture, forest die-offs. It's really pretty dramatic how many examples there are and how far along the climate change path we've moved.
Meanwhile, soon after this international report hit world headlines, leading climate scientists in New Hampshire released their own predictions for the Granite State. But in addition to their forecast for a warmer and wetter future, they also looked at how communities might adapt, from road construction to farming methods to better home cooling techniques. Today in The Exchange, preparing New Hampshire for climate change. And later in the hour, we'll look at huge changes in the flood insurance program. But first, let's hear from you on this. What adaptations do you see your city or town already making? What more could they do to better prepare for this possible new world? The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Post a comment on Facebook, NHPR Exchange, all one word. With me in studio, Cameron Wake, climatology professor at the UNH Institute for the Study of Earth, Oceans, and Space. He co-authored UNH's new report on climate change in New Hampshire. And Cameron, it's great to see you. Thank you for being here.
Morning, Laura.
Also with us, Michael Simpson, climate adaptation scientist and chair of environmental studies department at Antioch University, New England, which just announced a new center to study climate change preparedness. And Michael, nice to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Laura.
Well, Cameron, I want to start with you, and let's just get some of the highlights from this research that you did on climate change impacts on southern and northern New Hampshire, two different reports, although very similar. What's already happened, Cameron? What are we already seeing?
Well, I'd like to start the conversation with three main points here, Laura. The first point is that climate changes. It always has and always will. But now there's an extensive body and growing body of evidence that shows that human beings are actually the primary driver of climate change. And in fact, 97% of climatologists around the world are convinced this is the case. The second point is that New Hampshire's climate has been getting warmer and wetter over the course of the past century, and the rate of change has actually increased over the course of the past four decades. So what we're seeing is rising temperatures, primarily in winter and primarily in minimum temperatures, so warmer nights. We're seeing a significant increase in the frequency of extreme precipitation events, and those are defined many different ways, and they're all increasing. We're seeing earlier ice out dates on our lakes, which is particularly concerned for me because I love to play pond hockey, and we're seeing rising sea levels. The other part of our report really shows that we can expect these trends to continue into the future. So we're headed for a New Hampshire that has more heat waves in summers, warmer winters, less snow on the ground, more extreme precipitation events and rising seas. And then the last point really is that I see climate change as the innovation opportunity for the 21st century. That's both in terms of how we figure out how to reduce our emissions of heat-trapping gases via energy efficiency and renewable energies, but also really how we develop our civic structures around figuring out how we adapt to the new climate normal. And so our hope from this report is that we've provided a whole suite of very localized information for regional and local planners across the state, and we hope this information is integrated into their decision-making process and planning about investments in the future of our communities and hopefully making those communities more sustainable and more resilient.
Well, and that's exactly where you come in, isn't it, Michael Simpson? Antioch's been focusing on community response. What have these changes that have already happened, that Cameron outlines, meant for New Hampshire cities and towns? What have they had to put up with that maybe they didn't have to put up with, you know, 20, 30 years ago?
Well, there's two parts to that. One is just responding to extreme events that are out of the scale of history and building their preparedness, emergency response infrastructure to do that. And we've seen a lot of movement forward. Perry Plummer, who's head of the Homeland Security for the state, basically has taken many steps to move that agenda forward. Also, a lot of people have responded to hardware. That is, when things need to be replaced, such as culverts, they are starting to enlarge culverts. But as Cameron said, the true adaptation of a community is basically institutionalizing adaptation strategies into what they already do through their master plans, their building codes, their subdivision regulations, and things like open space planning.
Give us some examples on the ground of what you're talking about. You know, you mentioned culverts, for example. Just give us a couple more sort of bricks and mortar examples.
For example, Cameron's estimates of the future increase in summer temperatures is going to create increase what we call heat islands in cities and communities. And many cities have started to look very seriously at changing their, removing asphalt or changing the types of streets they have, making them much more tree-covered, and also changing their building codes to deal with the new energy demands that are going to come with higher temperatures. So you don't see these things necessarily because they're just planting the trees. They haven't grown up yet. But, you know, when we talk about climate change, we're talking about something that's happening in the future. His projections are into the 21st century, but we don't know when things are going to actually happen. As a result, we need to do what's called adaptive management. We have to make changes, and then we measure things, we evaluate them, and then 10, 15 years, we're probably going to have to make some new changes. So that's the strategy of how you adapt at the local level.
Again, our number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Today in the exchange, we're looking at some new numbers surrounding climate change's impact here in the Granite State, and looking at adaptation, what communities need to do to prepare for this emerging reality, what some are already doing. Let's hear from you. What do you see your city and town doing to prepare for this possible future? 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And Cameron, I want to get into some of your predictions. You've got a not-so-bad scenario and then a bad scenario. But before we do, Cameron, as you and Michael both know, this winter here in New England and much of the northern part of the country was pretty harsh, leading some to say, Cameron, what global warming? I'm freezing, polar vortex, endless snow. So how do you work what we saw this winter into these dire predictions from both you at UNH and from the IPCC?
I think this is a great question, Laura, and one that I get a lot. And so I think really important here is that in a world that's being warmed by greenhouse gases, it's not that we're never going to have cold, snowy winters in New Hampshire. It's just that the odds of a cold, snowy winter are going to go down. The one thing that we know about New Hampshire climate is the dazzling uncertainty of it, as Mark Twain said. And so there's considerable variability from year to year. But what we've seen in the recent past and what we expect to see in the future is we will have fewer and fewer of these cold, snowy winters. It's just really, I guess the other piece I would add to that is that we've had about a decade of not so harsh winters. So the winter that we had this year was much like I remember in Montreal when I grew up there. We're not used to these cold, snowy winters anymore. So it was such a big impact. So we're just going to see less of them in the future, but we will still have them occasionally. And it's really the difference between weather and climate. We look at long-term averages as opposed to specific weather. And so we had a cold, snowy winter, and they're going to continue, but we're not going to have as many of them.
Well, did this winter sort of take some of the juice out of your efforts, maybe made people a little less concerned about these predictions?
There's people who have an agenda for this country not to deal with the issue of climate change, and I think it gives them a good talking point. But there are certainly, if you go back and look at what climate scientists have saying, we expect there to actually be more variability in the climate system, not less, because of all this energy that's in the system, more heat energy. And as a result of that increased thermal energy, we get more evaporation, we have more moisture in the atmosphere. As long as it's cold in winter, we can still get more snow. So in some ways, warmer winters in the near term will result in more snow. And that's especially true for parts of New England that are downwind of the Great Lakes, where the lake ice is retreating. But so we're creating a new source of moisture.
Wow.
So that variability is really a big challenge for communities. And we expect it to be more variable in the future, not less.
Well, and that's a great point. And variability is tough, Michael, for communities to work around. I mean, if you know what's going to happen, you can plan for it. But if you're not really sure whether it's going to be super snowy one year or super wet one year, how do you even begin to plan and budget for that? I mean, New Hampshire towns are not stuffed with cash.
That's understandable, and uncertainty is one of the biggest challenges in moving the agenda forward at the local level. However, you know, the towns have been experiencing extreme events. We've had, since 1970, the number of extreme events, especially large storms and flooding, has hit the Northeast substantially, and it's quite different than the frequency that came before 1970. And so these people have experienced this, and what the storms have shown, and some of these storms are on the scale of the projections that Cameron's making about the future, it shows the vulnerability of the community. And so, we basically use what people already know to basically foment action and response. And we had a project in the Sunapee watershed where we actually didn't mention greenhouse gas or climate change. All we were dealing with was vulnerability to runoff. And so our biggest proponents at the end of that project were road agents.
Because they're tired of repairing these roads that get just washed out year after year.
Exactly. So, you know, the preparedness is just making us more resilient, okay? And so we focus on the things that people are experiencing first, but there's a whole series of vulnerabilities that come from Cameron's projections that we would go to a community, and we actually train our students to do that now. To identify if this is what the science is saying, these are where your vulnerabilities are, here are your options.
Take off some of those vulnerabilities, if you would, because, again, this is a lot for folks to wrap their heads around, Michael. So you mentioned roads. You mentioned culverts. What else? What are some sort of obvious targets?
More ice storms. Basically, the distribution system for electricity is threatened. Okay, so if you have a centralized electrical system, you'll have tree downs and you'll have isolated communities. And we've seen this with the ice storms where communities have been isolated for weeks. And so the move is to decentralize and actually back up or duplicate energy sources, and especially for vulnerable populations. And that's one of our focuses. It's just not where's the vulnerability, but who is the most vulnerable that we want to focus on.
All right. A lot more conversation in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 919. Good morning. Winter is hard on cars, especially in New Hampshire. If you're thinking about upgrading your car, truck, or motorhome this spring, why not donate your old one to NHPR? It's easy. We fill out the paperwork and arrange for the pickup and sale of your vehicle. Call 1-877-393-NHPR to get things started, or go online to nhpr.org. More on adapting to climate change coming up on The Exchange, then a 10 on the Diane Rehm Show, How the Civil Rights Act Changed America. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and Granite State Credit Union, with 6 branches statewide, providing full financial services to businesses and residents, including mortgages, online banking, and more. GSCU.org. From the City of Claremont, information about Claremont's investments in sustainable growth at ClaremontNH.com. And Kern Hatton Homes for Children, helping children in need grow physically, intellectually, emotionally, and socially. Information at HelpForKids.org. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, how New Hampshire communities are planning to adapt for climate change, extreme weather events, more extreme temperatures. Join us with your questions and comments. What might this mean for your city and town? What adaptations are already happening in your community? What more needs to be done? Join us, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email us, exchange at nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page if you like, NHPR Exchange, all one word. Our guests are Michael Simpson. He's climate adaptation scientist and chair of the Environmental Studies Department at Antioch University, New England. And Cameron Way, climatology professor at the UNH Institute for the Study of Earth, Oceans, and Space. And both of you, before we go to our listeners, Cameron, as I said earlier, you just came out with a new report looking at climate change in southern and northern New Hampshire. You talked about what we've already seen, rising temperatures and a growing number of extreme weather events. You got 2 predictions, though, Cameron, sort of the worst case scenario. We do nothing about greenhouse gases. We continue willy-nilly. And then you have a better scenario. It's not great, but it's not terrible. So give us the bad news first.
I'll frame this up by saying the future climate is literally in our hands. The decisions we make today and over the next decade about how we produce and use energy is going to determine what our future climate is. And that really drives these two different scenarios, high emission scenarios where we continue to use fossil fuel versus a low emission scenarios where we invest in energy efficiency and renewable technology and help the developing world do that. And so we use those two scenarios because it's really difficult to predict human behavior out 1 year, let alone decades or by the end of the century. So we use those two scenarios to frame the problem. So if we look at the higher emission scenarios, we see dramatic change across New Hampshire's climate in the coming century. Probably the most significant issue is a tripling of extreme precipitation events.
A tripling? Yeah. Wow. That's a lot of washed out picnics and birthday parties and weddings.
Unless, of course, we begin to prepare for that and make our communities more resilient to this flooding. We also see an increase of 4 to 5 to 6 times in the number of extreme hot days. Those are days above 90 degrees Fahrenheit. That happens more in southern New Hampshire than in northern New Hampshire, but northern New Hampshire starts experiencing 20 to 30 of these days in the future, end of the century, as opposed to the few that they experience today. We're also expect to see significant decreases in the number of snow-covered days across New Hampshire and warming winters, and that's going to have a real impact on our winter recreational opportunities. Ski areas can adapt by blowing more snow as long as it's cold enough, but by the end of the century, under the high emission scenarios, they can't do that much anymore. But cross-country ski areas and ice fishermen and snowmobilers really aren't going to have much of an adaptive strategy here, and I fear we're going to lose that part of our culture under the high emission scenario. The low emission scenario, conversely, has a lot of change that we likely can adapt to and maintain some semblance of sort of the seasons that we've come to love across much of New Hampshire.
So the low emission scenario is we turn more to non-fossil fuel sources of energy. Carbon dioxide emissions go down and things change, but not nearly as dramatically.
Absolutely. There is an important point I should add there is that there is an amount of change that's baked into the system. So whether or
already.
So and that's because when I drove over here today from the seacoast, I emitted carbon dioxide that's going to be in the atmosphere for well over 100 years. And the climate system itself has considerable inertia. It takes a long time to change. There's a lot of heat that's stored in the ocean, for example. So when we look out to 2050, there's really very little difference in our projections of climate change between the high emissions and low emissions scenario. It's going to be a warmer, wetter New Hampshire. We're going to have to deal with that. And that's really a planning horizon that planners deal with, sort of 10 to 20, maybe 30 years. And then the real difference is out at the end of the century, whether we follow the high emissions or the low emissions scenario. And that's not just New Hampshire. That's important to note. That's global emissions that are going to be driving our climate here in New Hampshire. So it's the global community that really needs to figure out how to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions if we want to be on the low emissions scenario.
Okay, Michael, I have a question for you too. But while we're talking about projections, especially as far out as the end of the century, here's an email that came in from Rob. He says, aren't global warming predictions based solely on computer models that are in turn based on assumed data? Al Gore predicted as recently as 2009 that, quote, the North Pole would be ice-free by 2013. It makes these predictions of doom very hard to take seriously when they are made regularly, but never seem to come true. When one doesn't come true, it's replaced by another dire prediction, and on it goes. So some skepticism from Rob, and thank you, Rob, for the email, not just about how much the climate may be changing, but also just, you know, computer models can have flaws.
Absolutely. There's a common axiom is that all models are wrong. Some models are useful. In fact, global climate models are incredibly useful tools. And if you look to the scientific literature and you look back even to the early models, the projections that they made for climate change were actually dead on. The place where they have been lacking has really been none of those models predicted the rapid decline in Arctic sea ice that we've seen. And so, in fact, in many cases, the models are underestimating the rapid change in the system. And that's because the Earth has a whole suite of very complex, what we call feedback loops. We could call them, in more common language, vicious cycles. So once you reduce a little bit of snow, the ground warms up and you reduce a lot more snow. And that's what is happening with Arctic sea ice. But they're very useful tools. And when you look to the scientific literature, those models have done a good job at forecasting the change that we've already seen.
And again, from these forecasts down on the ground to the community level, you know, we've seen a lot of extreme weather events in recent years, as both of you have said. And Michael Simpson, you've talked about some of the community vulnerabilities, roads, bridges, electric grids, and so forth. New Hampshire really lucked out when Hurricane Irene hit a couple years back. But just over the border from where you are in Keene, in Vermont, they were not so lucky. What did we learn about climate change preparedness from Vermont's experience with Irene?
Obviously, the biggest impact was to water conveyance infrastructure. That is basically the streams where they met built infrastructure, which was the roads. And what we learned is that something has been going on besides climate change, and I got to be very honest, that we've been building out our landscape and putting more impervious surface on it. So the two came together.
Impervious surface means
cement or asphalt or rooftops.
Doesn't suck up water, just it rushes off.
And so Irene was an extreme event, but it coupled with more impervious surface so that the vulnerable points were where roads met historic culverts, bridges, et cetera. And as a result, we basically cut off populations. We cut off towns for quite a long time. We learned a lot about electricity, providing electricity. Learned a lot about communication from that storm and how to better keep communication going. There was a lot of learning around emergency response, and it has improved dramatically since that event.
Emergency response meaning just rescuing people in trouble or more than that?
More than that, building in the resilience so that when it occurs again, there's a better response, decentralizing the safety net that's out there, and as opposed to having one fire station, having it decentralized so that it gets to if one gets cut off, others are there for support. So it's actually has moved the agenda much further in that aspect of adaptation.
Well, in Sandy, we saw that in the New York area, and I'm wondering what other lessons we can pull from that. Now, New Hampshire doesn't have as much coast, but still.
Well, the one thing that is probably the most obvious change is we are seeing a sea level rise, and that is measurable. And we know that, you know, during storm events, where you have storm surges on top of a full moon and high tide, we're seeing what the extent of flooding could be. A recent release by the White House on Climate Data Initiative basically wants to create data so planners can make decisions, and their first focus is on sea level rise with this data initiative, because it is unlike the inland, the line of where the tide goes can be drawn pretty easily. When you talk about inland events and inland vulnerabilities, it's so decentralized and the landscape so variable.
Inland meaning lakes and rivers and so forth.
And valleys.
And who knows how they're going to react. We saw that in your area of the state with the flood in Alsted six years ago.
Yeah, the Alsted flood in 2005 basically, and a number of events since then have shown the communities what they need to do. And you're actually starting to see Keene and the surrounding communities starting to change their infrastructure in order to adapt to that. The thing about changing infrastructure is you don't need to change it until you do, but realize once you've done it, it's there for the life of the infrastructure. And so it's very important if you're going to change a wastewater treatment facility, you're going to change a culvert, realize that's a 30 to 60 year decision. So you have to bring in possibilities of a variable climate into that decision.
The possibility of a 100-year storm, which seems to be happening every 5 or 6 years or so. All right, let's go to our listeners. Gentlemen, again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And Marjorie is calling from Hanover. Hi, Marjorie. Go ahead. You're on the exchange.
Good morning.
Morning.
I'd like to comment. Your speaker mentioned a couple things, and one is decreasing our emissions. I'd like to mention there's a lot of efforts right now regarding solarizing your home, and there's a group that's working actually across the Vermont and New Hampshire border called Solarize the Upper Valley. And solar prices right now are at historic lows, and they work with homeowners to get even better prices because they get groups of people and they get a volume discount. And that's an excellent effort and an excellent way. It's a good time right now to purchase and decrease your emissions. And then the other thing regarding the floods, I don't think anyone's mentioned that we really need to protect our wetlands to deflect and decrease the effect of those bad storms. And the New Hampshire DES is going around the state right now having a lot of listening meetings to take input on just, you know, how and why, and we should do that. And I know I haven't been particularly pleased with how some of the wetlands in my town have been protected, and I'd like to see better protection of them.
Okay, Margie, thanks a lot for the call. And financial incentives, Michael, to change to non-fossil fuel sources of energy.
Well, first, can I respond to the comment? I was originally trained as a wetland scientist. So one of the things that we're finding is, you know, just a hardware fix is not enough. If a town enlarges all its culverts, all it's doing is pushing the flood down to the next town. And on a larger scale of adaptation, we need to think about what do we preserve on the landscape that's going to mitigate how extreme the impact is. And so the caller's point of preserving wetlands is a very, very good point.
So we're helping ourselves out when we do
this. It is an adaptation strategy that needs to be looked at seriously, is what on the landscape do we preserve in order to mitigate how extreme the impacts are going to be at the vulnerable points.
Yeah, do you want to jump in, Cameron?
I'd love to jump in on the solar aspect here. We, in the Climate Action Plan, we called for improving the energy efficiency of our homes by 60%, every home across New Hampshire, and that really requires significant investment. But Marjorie's point is a good one, is that we need to be considering solar and geothermal and biomass energy if we really want to lay the foundation for our energy security in the future. And the big challenge here, frankly, is going to be the investment. Where's the money going to come from? There's some small government subsidies that can help, but we really need to figure out how to get private money into the game. And there's some organizations across New Hampshire that are doing this. Community Loan Fund helps businesses actually invest in their energy efficiency so they can be more effective businesses in the future. The recently formed New Hampshire Clean Tech Council is really trying to figure out how we invest in energy efficiency and renewables in this state. So we really need to figure out how we get the private money to help homeowners and businesses make that transition. And frankly, we don't mind fossil fuels in New Hampshire and New England, so they do very little use for our economy. If we're going to improve our energy security and actually really improve the opportunities for employment, we really need to invest in energy efficiency and renewables.
Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Marjorie, thanks a lot for that call. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org. You know, Cameron Wake, you talked earlier about that less good scenario, the pessimistic scenario where New Hampshire gets a lot warmer and a lot wetter, and the less bad scenario, the more optimistic scenario where, yes, it changes, but not quite so much. But you said that's going to depend on us using a lot less fossil fuels. How optimistic are you, Cameron, about getting to this future, given the opposition we've seen to, you know, all sorts of alternative energy, from wind to hydro to nuclear to whatever?
I think it's a tremendous challenge, and I don't see us having as made much progress as I would have liked our region or our nation to have made. But I will say, in the state of New Hampshire, we are absolutely on the right path, and we are now decoupling economic growth from greenhouse gas emissions. So while our gross state product continues to go up, our greenhouse gas emissions have been dropping since 2004.
Wow. Now, how did we do that?
There was a whole range of reasons that happened. One is the price of oil and gasoline went up. There was a range of different energy efficiency measures that were made affordable. And it's a complex reaction to a whole suite of market forces. There's only not one particular thing, but there's no doubt that the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative has had a significant effect. And that's really one where we help utilities generate energy with more low-carbon fuels. The big challenge, though, is that we have to do this globally. So we are figuring out how to do that in the United States and Europe, but we now need to help China and India and Indonesia as those economies grow. And we need to ensure that they can grow in a way that was different from how we grew, which was relying on fossil fuel energy.
Yeah, so and don't if we, do it the way we did it.
If they follow that pathway, really, there is no doubt we will be on the high emission scenario.
Let's take another call if we could. George is in Effingham. Hi, George. Thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Hi, I've just got a kind of a comment. I've noticed that, at least in my community, a lot of people who are advocating for adaptation are then the same people who are opposed to it once it's specifically applied. So, for example, people are in favor of wind power, but then once there's an actual proposal, they're opposed to the specific one in their backyard or whatever. And I see that as a big challenge in that the same proponents for renewable energies turn out to be the people that actually oppose it. And I see that as a major hindrance for adapting.
Yeah, George, it's a great question. And this is what I was trying to get at with you, Cameron, and Michael, I want to hear from you, too. You know, it's one thing to say I love a green energy future. It's another thing to say, ooh, I don't want that nuclear power plant down the road. Or the wind turbine, or the hydro tower.
So it's a big challenge to transform an energy system. We've been through a couple of these in sort of Western civilization, and it takes a long time, sort of on the average of 40 to 60 years. So we're beginning to see that discussion going on now. And I think it's important for communities to pipe up if, in fact, they don't want that big wind turbine in their backyard. But I also think we have to be a little bit more strategic about how we approach this issue. And that's now happening across the state of New Hampshire, especially with wind. Where are we going to site wind? Where's the best place for that in the future? I'd also say that there's lots that individuals can do, and we should not be looking to state government to solve this problem. So individuals can make their homes much more energy efficient. They can be generating much of the energy they need. We can really look at the way our transportation system works and really invest in those local communities across New Hampshire that we love. So everybody in New Hampshire can actually walk to get a gallon of milk, and we have walking communities. So there's lots that communities can do. It's not just big energy projects.
So that's some of the low-hanging fruit, right, Michael?
It is, and I just want to make the point that, you know, a decentralized system, especially in a variable climate, is an important way in which to adapt. And decentralized energy systems will actually, you know, support our economy and actually allow our economy to grow because the jobs will be here. You know, if you have a centralized system where the, you know, where energy sources are coming from far afield and where the capital is really being put, it's outside the state, but if we go to a decentralized approach, we actually will have more security here, more resilience to adapt and respond, and actually we will actually be hiring people to do this work. We need to install this. We need to, you know, look at these. Now, not in my backyard's always been a challenge for us as environmentalists and scientists, It's not easy to manage change, but, you know, change has to be managed and we have to move forward.
All right. Well, guys, it's been really good to talk to you. Interesting stuff. Thank you for being here. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much,
okay,
Laura.
Thank you.
Cameron Wake, climatology professor at the UNH Institute for the Study of Earth, Oceans, and Space, and Michael Simpson, climate adaptation scientist at Antioch University, New England. Coming up, as floods become more of a threat, more people may need flood insurance, but there's a lot of controversy surrounding the federal flood insurance program. We'll find out more in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 939. Good morning.
On the next I and Rheem show, how the Civil Rights Act changed America, their new efforts to bring extinct species back to life, all coming up on the Diane Rheem Show.
The Diane Rheem Show this morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. New Hampshire weather, sunshine today, high temperatures mid-50s to lower 60s, partly cloudy in the evening, then mostly cloudy, a chance of rain showers after midnight, lows tonight mid-30s to lower 40s. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and support also comes to us from Geriatric Psychiatry Services at Frisbee Memorial Hospital in Rochester, specializing in mental and behavioral health for people 65 and older in outpatient or inpatient settings, frisbeehospital.com. And from Mill Falls at the Lake, Four Inns offering Winnebosaukee Lakefront Lodging, 7 restaurants, 12 marketplace shops, the Cascade Spa, and Ekel Lake Activity Center, millfalls.com.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. For the rest of the hour, we're going to focus on the rising cost and rising controversy over flood insurance. We're speaking with Rick Stevens, a Concord-based correspondent for the Associated Press, who's been following the flood insurance debate. He's Northern New England correspondent for the AP. And Rick, it's nice to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, President Obama just signed a new law to change how federal flood insurance works. And you wrote about how this could affect New Hampshire. But just back up for a minute, if you could, please, Rick. First off, most people get their car insurance and other types of insurance from private companies. Why is flood insurance federal?
That goes back to the 1960s, Laura, when most of the private companies got out of the market, leaving this void that the federal government wanted to fill. So they began offering these subsidized insurance policies in, you know, mostly hard-hit areas that you think of, coastal areas, Louisiana and the Gulf Coast, Florida, et cetera. But they were also offering these subsidized policies to homeowners and business owners nationwide.
So why did they get out? Did it just get too expensive? I'm talking about the private companies now.
Exactly.
Why did they decide?
It was simply too expensive for the private companies to stay in business. It wasn't lucrative enough for them.
Wow. So they got out and the federal government said, okay, somebody's got to provide flood insurance for folks. And the Fed stepped in.
That's right.
Now, President Obama, as you've written and as I said, recently signed big changes to this law. But from what I understand, Rick, this is in response to a big fix that Congress passed 2 years ago. What was the big fix supposed to do? What was the big problem that people were worried about?
Let's go back a little ways. When you start looking at some of the past storms, Katrina, of course, 2005 was a bad year for floods in general. You had Rita, Katrina, Wilma, all in the same year.
And then we had a couple of big ones here in New Hampshire.
We had a couple of big ones in New Hampshire in 2005, 6, and 7, of course. And then you fast forward, you had Irene, and then Superstorm Sandy. And this flood insurance program was literally underwater. It was some $24 billion in debt after – by the time Superstorm Sandy hit, it was $24 billion in debt. And the federal government said, whoa, we got to stop subsidizing these policies. We're going to change the way we do business. They, in 2012, adopted legislation that would automatically, starting this year, increase policies from anywhere up to 18% for a private homeowner, a family homeowner. And then starting at 25% for commercial properties. So think of condos, vacation rentals, businesses that were in these flood zones. The howls from the business community were fast and loud.
Well, 25% is a lot.
Oh, yeah. And that was a baseline. That was starting at 25% for the businesses.
So this was based on new, you know, information, new extreme storms, as you described, Rick, and new flood maps, right? What role do the flood maps play in these rising insurance rates?
Well, the flood maps put a lot more properties in into the flood zone. So suddenly people who were never had to have flood insurance suddenly did. And we analyzed, the Associated Press analyzed some 18,000 communities nationwide. And places, again, you expect to see flood insurance in places like the Gulf Coast.
Florida.
Florida, exactly. Miami, St. Petersburg. But they were showing up in Keene and in Coos County and in middle America where there aren't these coastal events. So the outcry was very loud. And that last month, the president signed a bill rolling back the increases, just delaying them, not eliminating them. But they're going to phase them in now.
Okay, a couple more questions for you, Rick. I also want to invite our listeners to join us, though, as we look at changes in the flood insurance program. You've probably heard about some of these changes. Insurance rates going up a lot based on these superstorms we've been having and new flood maps that Rick Stevens is telling us about. Join us with your questions and comments, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Post a comment on our Facebook page if you'd like, NHPR Exchange, all one word. So they put out these new flood maps, and all of a sudden people in Keene or Coos County were saying, whoa, I'm not in a flood zone. Give us a little bit more there, Rick, if you could.
Sure. I spoke with a realtor on, and I'll take a place that is in a flood zone, the coastline of New Hampshire, even though it's small, 13 or 14 miles. Bob Preston has been in the real estate business down there for decades. He's a second generation realtor down there. He, in more than 40 years, has never had a flood in his properties. And suddenly Bob is facing these 25% minimum increases in his premiums, in his flood insurance premiums. So take a look at say, a property, and these are averages, but a property now, if you're paying $1,300 annually in flood insurance, within 5 years, you'll be paying twice that. And in 10 years, you could be paying $5,000 a year in flood insurance. Bob Preston worries that he won't be able to rent his vacation properties. Homeowners worry that they can't sell in these zones.
Because the flood insurance is too expensive.
Sure. If you have a mortgage with a bank, it's going to be required if you're in that map. You have to have the flood insurance. There's no way out. So people have to hold on to their homes much longer than they anticipated or simply not sell them at all.
So this is a real hardship for homeowners and commercial building owners who are all of a sudden on this new map, didn't even realize that they were considered vulnerable. What's the other side of this, though, Rick? I mean, there was a big push, as you said, a couple years back, to change this. What's the taxpayer side of this subsidized flood insurance story?
Well, that's the word, subsidized, and that's always sort of a tricky word to get around. The complaint is that people in Keene and Coos and Middle America were paying for huge storms in places like Louisiana and on the Gulf Coast and Florida and Miami. And certainly those storms are well documented. So you have some areas that are reaping terrific benefits in terms of payments, insurance payments, whereas other states like New Hampshire, since the program started in New Hampshire in 1978, about $48 million in claims have been paid in New Hampshire. New Hampshire property owners are paying some $9 million a year in premiums. So you can see the imbalance there. That was the underlying complaint.
Okay. Let's take some calls if we could, Rick. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Join us as we talk about new and controversial changes to the federal flood insurance program. Rick Stevens is with us, Northern New England correspondent for the Associated Press. This has been a big issue nationally. Rick's been looking at its impact here in the Granite State. Let's get your questions and comments in at 1-800-892-6477. And Richard's calling from Portland. Hi, Richard. Thanks for joining us. Go ahead.
Yes, thanks. We have specific experience with Portland condominiums on the waterfront where flood insurance went from $300 to $3,800.
Wow.
And
per unit.
And that per unit, yes. And the building itself has flood insurance on the first floor, but each unit, if they're mortgaging their units, has to secure $250,000 worth of coverage, and the cost for that is $3,800. And previously, the insurance was able to be transferred to the new owner from the old owner, and then that 18% or 25% wouldn't be as striking. But that was repealed. Now that the new well, the previous law is repealed. I'm not sure exactly how that's going to play out with insurance companies. Would the person who ended up having to pay the $3,800 have to? Would they get a rebate?
Well,
and what's the base for the 25 and 18% going forward?
And Richard, where are these condos that you're talking about again, please?
They're in Portland on the waterfront.
They're in Portland on the waterfront. What do you think this? What's your philosophical feeling about this, Richard? You know, the idea that, sure, it's a hardship to have your flood insurance go up so much. On the other hand, it is a federal subsidy. You guys are choosing to be on the waterfront, so there's a risk there. So I just wonder what you think about the balance there.
Well, I think perhaps people should pay their own way, of course, but such a drastic difference. Phasing it in, I think, would be reasonable, I think, but... And of course, on the waterfront, these properties are expensive. So the relative price from, say, $400,000 relative to $3,800 is not as drastic as it would be, as you mentioned, in Louisiana and the Florida coast, where more modest homes are, and the flood insurance would be the same.
Sure.
A $50,000 house having a $4,000 flood insurance would be sometimes impossible to meet.
Sure. And all of a sudden, maybe you're a tiny homeowner on a river that, you know, all of a sudden is called a risk on the new flood maps. A couple points from Richard's call. Thank you very much, Richard, for joining us, Rick. First of all, he said, sure, people should pay their fair share, but this increase was so big and so sudden.
Oh, sure. And that explains why Congress, in a rare bit of bipartisanship just this year, agreed to roll back the increases. But what's unclear, and Richard, you make a good point, that there's a lot of uncertainty. FEMA hasn't said how they will raise these rates. Yes, the maximum of 18% for a family-owned, a single-family home, that's going to happen. But how and when, we just don't know yet. The minimum of 25%. Per unit on a business or a rental property, we don't know how that's going to happen yet, and FEMA hasn't set a deadline for when they'll come up with new regulations. So there is a lot of uncertainty about whether those rates will be passed on to a new homeowner, who must assume the rates. There's a confusion.
All right. Well, again, thank you for that call, Richard. The number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You know, Rick, in your story, you wrote that the change would affect about 3,800 people in New Hampshire. You mentioned some of them live on the seacoast, but where else? Where were some of the surprise spots where you and the folks affected said, wow, I didn't know this affected me?
Well, I was surprised to see a great number of claims in the historical data that we compiled in the Keene area. Now, I talked to a couple of geologists and topographers who just simply explained that Keene is sort of a bowl. So it doesn't have the big water of an ocean or a major river running through it, but it has a lot of little ones that collect there. So there can be a lot of claims there. Again, we saw most of the claims were along the coastline. And in talking to Bob Preston, the realtor down in Seabrook, he said it can really be hit or miss. One home can get flooded and a home a block away might escape it just because of the way the land is carved out there.
Here's an email that just came in from Travis in Charlestown. And Travis, thank you. He says, although the flood maps added many properties to flood zones, the work seems to be faulty. In some places, the flood zone is not located in the correct location. The brook itself is sometimes not considered flood zone. However, a house up the hill on the other side of the road is considered in the flood zone. Travis says, problem number one, logistically, it's difficult to trust this work. Problem two, he says, taxpayers paid for these flood maps to be created, and now individual property owners are spending thousands to pay engineers to file with FEMA to have the property removed from the flood zone for properties that Travis says were incorrectly placed in the flood zone in the first place. So lots of confusion and controversy about these maps themselves and who should be in and who should be out.
Well, and that was part of the outcry as well, that when they first passed the law back in 2012. Now, homeowners now, if you purchase a home and need to get a mortgage, the first thing you're going to need to do is get an elevation survey. Some of these surveys can cost hundreds, maybe thousands of dollars, depending on the complexity of the property. It's going to add to the cost of your buying that house. But there could be an upside, and Travis, you're right, there may be houses that were improperly included in the flood zones. Now, our reporting didn't go too deeply into that element of the story, but if this flood elevation survey shows you are within the correct parameters, you can be taken out of that flood zone.
Yeah, it's interesting. And as we talk so much about flood zone, thank you, Travis, for that. You know, even people who aren't in a flood zone, and I don't think I am, although I haven't looked at the map lately, Rick, there are these extreme weather events where all of a sudden it just pours for hours and hours and hours. And, you know, our basement, just like many people's, is in danger of being flooded. So should we have flood insurance even if we're not in a flood zone?
You know,
I'm not asking you to give, you know, insurance advice on the air, but.
Well, it's the you never know. And that factor drives all insurance, of course. You never know. Now, Bob Preston in Seabrook, he has flood insurance and he buys it and he swallows hard and he pays for it every
year.
He's the realtor. Yeah. That's correct. Even though he's never had a flood. But he says, I never know, especially living on the coast. So that really is, it's a personal decision from homeowner to homeowner, of course.
Is there any way to protect your home, Rick, from flooding costs without having to buy this federal insurance? Or if you want flood insurance, this is what you have to do.
There are some private companies who will offer it. You don't have to have the federal subsidized, but they're few and far between. And I don't know of any off the top of my head in New Hampshire that offer it specifically. That would be something that you'd have to talk to your broker about.
Yeah, interesting. Travis, thank you for the email. The email address is exchange@nhpr.org. 1-800-892-6477 is the number. So what happens next with this story, Rick? President Obama, as you said, signed a law recently giving people a little bit of a break, but I'm guessing eventually rates will go up.
Oh, yeah. There's no question that the rates will go up, and they'll go up by the amount that they agreed to in 2012. So, again, up to 18% annual increase for single families, starting at 25% for commercial properties. But the question is, and this still leaves a big question, is when and how will they be phased in? FEMA, Federal Emergency Management Agency, is the agency responsible for that. And they just simply don't have the rules promulgated yet. When that will happen, we don't know.
Yeah. So annual increases, though, that's a lot. It's not a one-time increase where you say, all right, I'll swallow it. Annual increase of 18%.
These are annual increases. That's right.
Wow, that's a lot. What's the political angle to this story, Rick? You know, behind every big change like this is a lot of politics. Sounds like there's already been some politics behind the scenes?
You know, the politics was actually fairly unified. Once it was there was a terrific outcry from the business community, mostly from realtors, from homeowners associations, from tourism groups, from chambers of commerce that worried about vacant blocks going unsold or unrented
because the flood insurance would be too expensive.
Right, it would be prohibitive to either buy or sell. So in 2013, both Democrats and Republicans got together and agreed that this was too fast, too soon, too much, and agreed to delay it. And of course, the president signed that last month. So the political dynamic was pretty down the middle, while the pressure from the business groups and the homeowners groups was extreme.
And I'm guessing pressures from some states were greater than others. Again, Florida, California, places that tend to have these extreme weather events and extreme flooding.
Sure, and places with a lot of coastline and a lot of vulnerability.
Is there anything that jumped out at you, Rick, looking again at this big federal program and the big, big changes that are being put into place, micro managing it down to New Hampshire? What jumped out at you from this?
Just the huge number of the increase, the debt of the program and the fact that it could go 40 years without any kind of adjustment at all, and then suddenly they wake up in 2012 and say, we've got to increase rates by 25%.
All right, Rick, it's great to have you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Rick Stevens, Northern New England correspondent for the Associated Press, talking to us about some of the major changes in the federal flood insurance program. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. The producers are Ellen Grimm and Faith Meixel. Our volunteer is Alan Cohen. Our intern is James Pouliot. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange's executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Kanoy, and tomorrow on The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. A Senate committee hears testimony on a bill to allow some patients to grow their own medical marijuana. Scott Brown finally announces his U.S. Senate campaign as Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders contemplates a run for the White House. And a Claremont substitute teacher is fired for friending students on Facebook. Send us your thoughts by email or Facebook and join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
The Diane Rehm Show, next at 10 on New Hampshire Public Radio, where support comes from you, our listeners, and from Heritage Plumbing, Heating, Cooling, Electric. Tune-ups, repairs, and efficient air conditioning systems, including ductless AC for homes without ductwork, online at justcallheritage.com. And Comcast Business continuously investing to keep customers ahead of the technology curve. Comcast Business is built for business. More at business.comcast.com.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO Concord 89.1.
WEVS Nashua 88.3.
WEVH Hanover 91.3.
WEVN Keene 90.7.
WEVC Gorham 107.1.
WEVJ Jackson 99.5.
WEVF Colebrook 90.3.
And WEVQ Littleton 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Diane Rehm. This year marks the 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights Act. President Lyndon Johnson overcame a determined filibuster by Southern lawmakers and signed the bill on July 2, 1964. The new law banned discrimination in public accommodations.